Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this spellbinding episode, authors Shubnam Khan and Genevieve Cogman explore the power of fantasy to reshape the past and reimagine the present. From an ancient djinn stirring in a ruined South African mansion to a vampiric plot unravelling in revolutionary England, both writers use the supernatural to confront buried stories, collective memory and untold grief. Recorded live at the 2025 festival, this rich conversation explores folklore, fantasy, historical fiction, and why the past is never quite as distant as it seems.
Thank you all for joining us for Haunted Histories. We are, as it promises, going to be talking about magic and memory, which I say like I don't remember that, and supernatural in fiction. We're also going to be talking about quite a bit more than that. And we're going to be leaving lots of time for you to ask questions about what you would like to talk about. So there's going to be lots of space for this. My name is Jared, and I am joined by the real stars of the show, which are Genevieve Cogman and Shubnam Khan. I mean, I'm pointing towards the books, but the actual people are here too. Genevieve, I'm going to pick on you first, but if you don't mind telling us a tiny bit about your book, one of very many, and they're all fabulous, but if you could tell us a tiny bit about the most recent series, which just concluded, and how it relates to magic and history.
The book over there, Scarlet, is the first in the Scarlet Revolution trilogy, of which the third one just came out last month. It's about the French Revolution, which did exist, and about the Scarlet Pimpernel, and the vampires, which, as far as we know, didn't actually exist. It's primarily a dramatic swashbuckler, but the vampires and later on the mages who show up are both, I suppose you could say, magical, or well, the vampires would actually claim they're natural. The vampires would claim that they've been around for the last couple of thousand years, that they're a normal part of nature and society, and that paying for a bit of blood from their servants a couple of times a week is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I mean, perfectly normal, socially acceptable. Vampires have lots of money. They will pay you money and you will give them their blood. This is normal. Also, the vampires say.
It seems completely reasonable to me. I've had worse jobs. Septim.
So The Djinn Waits 100 Years is a book. It's set in an Indian Muslim community in South Africa on the East Coast, which I don't think many people know. It's one of the biggest Indian populations outside of India. And I mean, that's where I grew up and that's where I live. And it's about a young girl who moves into a forgotten mansion along the ocean. And there's a group of eccentric characters who live in the rooms. And she discovers that there's a grieving djinn in one of the rooms that's just grieving something. There's some tragedy that has happened in this house. And so as she gets to know each of the characters, she's trying to understand what is love, because she's a young girl, she's 15. I mean, that's what I think at 15 I was trying to do. So the character is trying to do this. And she sets on this journey to figure out what is love. But as she's doing that, she uncovers the secrets of the house, which is she finds these diaries that tells her a story about what happened almost 100 years ago and the tragedy that happened in the house. And it goes back to almost 100 years ago when Indians first came into South Africa as sugarcane plantation workers by the British. And she discovers that there was a man who took on a second wife, and something happened and caused a death, and the djinn is now grieving this death and haunting this house.
In a weird way, I'm like, there's no way she can summarize her book in like under 5 minutes. And you did.
Every time it changes, I forget which part to go into and which part to leave out.
But it is obviously you did a very good job, but it is layers upon layers across sort of space and time, which is amazing. And I guess my first deeply annoying question is going to be, multiple cultures, multiple geographies, you have multiple time periods, you have mysteries, and then you add a supernatural element to it. So what is that? Why that last piece of icing on the cake? And Genevieve, I'm warning you, this is coming for you too. There's layers of history, of fiction, of literary interpretation, of espionage going in there. And then you're like, let's have a vampire. So What do these elements add?
I think I wanted to write a romance, but then you can't write a love story without writing a life story. So they were all different parts that got thrown into it. And also it took me like 9 years to write the book. So it was everything that interested me over 9 years. So, you know, I was interested in love and I was interested in adding tragedy and mystery. And it ends up being labeled as Gothic. I didn't even realize because Gothic has so many things in it, so many elements in it. And then the supernatural just came from wanting to be able to write a character, wanting to write human beings as extreme as they are. So the djinn is grieving and it's almost like a ghost. And I do feel like human beings, when you're deep into grief and you're really low, it's almost like you disappear and you're seen as something else, not human. And so I think the djinn just became a way to explore love in a very extreme way.
And so there is also an angry ghost.
That's true. There's an angry ghost, and I don't know how that angry ghost just walked onto the page and said, "I'm here." And it was beautiful because as a writer, it made it so easy for me. That character just took over the page. Book.
It was partly because I was thinking about all the things I enjoyed, and I was trying to work out what my next topic was going to be. And I was sort of basically writing down lists on pages, you know, and trying to look for avenues to explore or things to put together in interesting ways. And then I thought vampires and Scarlet Pimpernel, and I thought entrenched power structure versus revolution. And I thought innocent, well, moderately innocent protagonist, sheltered protagonist, who is intelligent but who's never had an education and always been on the same country estate and never been exposed to political matters apart from front page of the newspapers and gossip, and developing her own political consciousness, and vampires as aristocrats. You've probably already seen it in that book, but an insult that was used at the time was sanguinocrat, which was just so perfect I had to borrow it. And the effect of what happens when people in power get frightened about giving it up. What happens when the idea of enlightenment is spreading across Europe, is not just in France, it's not just in England. There are places across Europe, even further abroad, while meanwhile England is doing unpleasant colonising things in India and Africa and so on, so I will not brush over that. And people are developing new ideas. And when the people in power, even if it's power behind the scenes, are faced with that, how far would they go to shut it down? What might they do? What will somebody do to save themselves and everyone they consider dependent on them if they need blood to do it?
That's fascinating. So it's beyond the extended metaphor, isn't it? I mean, it starts taking a life of its own, and not just, I also like to put it, the fact that you said you started this as a love story and you actually started this as a list of joy, things that bring you joy. I mean, those are genuinely the sort of two emotions I got out of reading the books as well, that, you know, that Scarlet is deeply joyous despite being, you know, about people bleeding to death in a revolution, but or being bled to death. And Jen is lovable is not the right word. It is about love, and you really get that out of there. I do want to pick up on something you both have pointed out about the use of the supernatural. Like, at what point does having vampires as aristocrats or djinn or ghost that express the sort of worst of us, at what point does that almost absolve humans of responsibility?
It doesn't.
No, that was easy.
Sorry, I apologize, but... I mean, humans might like to think it absolves responsibility, but it doesn't, does it? I mean, if your question is, why do humans enjoy portraying these things as inhuman or supernatural in order to absolve themselves of the responsibility, whether it's conscious or subconscious, then I would say that it's just part of being human. We all want a convenient excuse.
Ken, and I've never seen it as... I've seen the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. When I described what the djinn was, it was just to show the most human emotion in the most extreme way.
And how do you, when you're writing that, how are you careful to make sure that humans are still the ones with, I suppose, with the agency, and that we're not, especially when you're working with something that crosses history, making sure that, you know, humans are still responsible for human decisions?
I would say that to some extent, my vampires are still human in a way. They still have human emotions. They still claim ethics, like the barrier, the war cry of half the factions in my book is, I'm just doing this in order to protect the people I'm responsible for, and vampires as much as humans. And on the other hand, the vampires wouldn't be half as terrified about what human enlightenment is bringing, about change that's coming to the world, if it couldn't affect them. The vampires are sort of attempting to either hide themselves or portray unchangeable attitude of that can't even be challenged, because they know all too well that the guillotine is waiting around the corner once the people start thinking about, you know, just exactly why are they always going to be there in power, using the money, controlling the politics and so on. Why can things not change?
Yeah, and I don't think I'm ever thinking of how do I keep the humans in charge. The djinn is just a djinn, or the supernatural being is just a supernatural being, and they exist, and how do they interact? Yeah, I'm never thinking about, yeah, no.
That's a fascinating area as well. Like, how do you, if you're mixing reality, and I'm going to use fantasy as sort of the broadest term here, did you set out with rules? So, you know, I'm going to have a djinn in this book, and therefore these are the like five things the djinn can and can't do, or did it flow more organically?
I mean, you might have a different, this might be different because I think our books are a little different. Mine is more like touching on fantasy a little bit, but I didn't think these are the rules of the world. For me, love or grief or memory are such intense emotions that it is like living in another world. You know, it is unworldly sometimes what you can feel or what you can remember or how much it hurts. Or, you know, emotion is so intense that I'm not thinking you're entering into another world, or this is, for me, a djinn is an extension of grief, or the angry sister who is, we don't say whether she's a ghost or she's alive or not alive. And she says, the sister asks her, what are you? And she says, I'm neither dead, I'm neither alive, I'm in between, I'm nothing, any of the things that you can define me by. And she's anger, or she's the thing that comes from guilt. She carries I'm not giving away too much by saying, but her sibling passed away as a child, and she carries this guilt that she was also supposed to die with her sister. And so we never know really if the sister is real or not in the book, but she follows her around. And the djinn, even when the djinn is feeling grief, it starts turning into the woman that it loves. So its nails start growing, and its hair starts growing, and its face starts changing, and its body and voice, and it walks around with a limp because she had a limp. And for me, it's just an extension of real life. The supernatural and magic and these things are just what we experience every day if we just like think or feel hard enough about it. Yeah.
Very nicely put. Genevieve.
As you said, our books are very different in style and topic and basically what they're treating. So I did have to work out some details of what vampires can and can't do. Because you're writing an adventure story about the heroes trying to escape from vampires, you have to work out a few rules. But as the plot goes on and the protagonist gets information from different sources as well as from her human and vampire acquaintances, she starts to get the impression that a lot of people don't really know what the truth is in terms of magic and vampires and so on. And the person who was her main teacher and who sort of said in absolute tones of this is how it is and this is how it works was perhaps a bit either didn't know or liked to pretend she knew when she didn't know. And basically there is a lot more out there. And there's a fact that also when various characters find out about the whole magic thing, some of them go, aha, we are in a new era of science. This is something that would have been called magic in the past, but now it is merely a new facet of existence. Like magnetism and hypnotism and whatever, we will simply have to find out how it works. And which is, so the author's attitude is one thing, the character's attitude is another.
Very much like what would have happened at the time too. Either we're going to dissect her or we're going to dissect her for science. That's it.
Well, the protagonist does get a bit twitchy when they talk about experiments.
With good cause. The sort of dreaded research question, but I mean, how did you approach this? Both of your books take place in different times and places and are written, I think, incredibly respectfully, including to the sort of literary source material as well. How much research goes into it? How did you, what sort of digging did you do?
So for me, it was a lot of oral history because we have two timelines. So we have the current time and then we have 1930s. And as a child, I would sit and listen to my grandfather tell stories about how he came to South Africa. So he would tell me about the ship. It was 1935. He came on the ship from India to South Africa, the journey that they made. I think it would play in my mind as I was growing up, this long journey, and his mother and him were third class. They were at the bottom and they would all get sick, and they would look at the people in the first class, and the food and the things that they would call out, like, here's food for the Musalman and here's food for the vegetarians. And he'd give like this whole journey of how he came. And when he came to South Africa, he'd put his mouth to the spout of the tap because they'd never seen running water in his village. And there was electricity and with a whole new land that he could come to. And so a lot of it is this, part of it is this journey that the couple make from India as they come to South Africa. So that was more the research part of it. And then just in terms of jinns and stuff, I played into a lot of stories, again, I was told growing up, which was jinns like to catch you from your hair. So they come in through your hair. And they like the ocean and the sea, and they like sitting in trees and watching you. And they like particular types of trees, and they like quiet places. And so that's why this house is haunted also by a jinn, because it's a kind of like an abandoned house. And jinns can fall in love with human beings, which is something I used in the story. So a lot of it was just oral storytelling growing up. And then just technical things in terms of, like, in the 1930s, you know, there's a scene where someone goes into the ceiling. I was like, oh, did they have those pull-down stairs at that time? Oh, no, they didn't have it. I missed it by a few years. And you can always change it, you're the writer, but I try to keep it historically accurate. I like the kind of songs that were playing at the time. It's very interesting also because I never realized, but the songs that you use, some of them are copyrighted. You can't, unless they pass a certain year, you can use them. But if not, then you have to try to approach somebody. And that's such a long story. And that's up to the author. That's not the publisher who does it. You have to try to approach people and ask them, can I use these lyrics from this song? Can I, you know, I'm just a little author. Please just give it to me for free.
Yeah.
So those kind of things.
I published a story once that had a Britney Spears, had a lyric weirdly reminiscent of Britney Spears in it. And there was sort of like, what is the minimum viable number of words you can use that make it sound like a Britney Spears song without it actually being a Britney Spears song? I'm sure we were wound up on the right side of that.
It just hit me.
just one, the word one. And was there a house? Did you have the house in mind? Because the house is such an amazing character in and of itself. Was there a source house?
So in Durban, it's very tropical. It's the east coast of South Africa. It's very lush. It's very green. And you know, there was one stage, I think, in the 80s and 70s and 80s when I think this is in a lot of cities, actually. There was a very grand time, so you can see all that architecture and the kind of money being pumped in. And then I think from the 90s, the municipality just went down and everything went down. And because it's so green and lush, it's like almost like the green is trying to take over. And you see these grand buildings with this green, like, sort of taking over, and this lushness and deterioration and breaking down. And it's so apparent everywhere you drive. So there's not one specific building and my father's an architect also, so he talks about buildings and he talks about designs. And so I think all that driving through all this kind of deterioration of buildings, grand buildings, and the greenery, and my father designing buildings, ultimately had to write about a house that is alive.
And it very much is. So back on research and source material. So there's the Baroness Orczy, is that how I actually, the author of The Pimpernel is?
Baroness Orczy, yes.
Orczy, okay.
I actually dedicated the third book to her to write out her full name, also known as Baroness Orczy.
Really?
Because, as I put it, you know, even though I have done dreadful things to her characters and stories, she wrote them first. So yes, I did reread a number of the Orczy books. And some of them are the sort of thing which when you're being tactful about it, you say, a book of its time, in terms of how it deals with anything other than white men or anything other than England's political system. But yes, so I was rereading those. I was going various other books on history, culture. I was rereading a fair number of my Georgette Heyer historical novels.
Yes.
Because while she is about 20, 30 years later in terms of the period she's set in, they're excellent for general feel, cadence of speech, and general attitude. I would have loved to have had Sir Percy be a member of the Four Horse Club, but alas, that was founded a bit too late, and that's the sort of detail people will spot. So loads of that, a certain amount of online facts, like trying to find plans of the Louvre, or older books, trying to find a map of Mont Saint-Michel, and books about how the stagecoaches worked. You know, public stagecoach, you pack about half a dozen people inside, you pack about another half dozen on top, along with all the luggage. You drive between inns, you change the horses at inns, you pray there aren't any accidents, and you hope the weather is decent, especially if you're one of the ones sitting on top.
And at what point do you stop? I mean, it sounds like you know, and I suspect many budding writers wind up in the loop where they just research infinitely and never actually say, you know what, I need to stop and start creating my own world out of all of these inputs.
I would say that you just have to, the thing is, you can put in too much detail, absolutely. This is something that I'm sure you all know. You've all run across historical fiction where the author was just having a wonderful time throwing in absolutely everything they'd read or researched, and one just ground to a halt on the icebergs of it. And sometimes you want to throw in the historical detail, like, oh, this is an optical telegraph, we have just invented it. It can send messages across France in a couple of hours. To which the protagonist goes, you have to be joking, that's totally ridiculous. How can such a preposterous thing work? And then there's stuff where, if you like, if you imagine a sort of television camera playing over the background detail before getting to the action, you might throw in a couple of historical points, like chickens in the inn yard, or people wearing red, white and blue rosettes, sashes, nobody without something like that. But it's not something you're to focus on in detail. And there's just sometimes where you have to bear it in mind as something the characters would have thought of and been informed by, such as beliefs, religion, attitudes, what they swear by, and the fact that the Mont Saint-Michel was being called Mont Michel at the time because they were getting rid of all that annoying religious stuff. And you just have to sort of drop it in and let the reader pick it up. I mean, Heyer was brilliant at that. Heyer just wrote and you just followed along, caught up in the wash of it, and I'm nowhere near that good. I wish I was.
I do think some authors are very clever about it. I can't do that, but they have, I read a book recently, Wild Shores. It's a beautiful book that came out this year, I think. Something with Wild Shores in it. But it's different perspectives of each character. And they had, and it's set in a lighthouse on an island. And there's the one character is a little boy who loves science. And so his chapter is always about like facts about nature and the dandelion and the way it travels, or certain animals that you find along the ocean, or detailed things that obviously the author was enjoying knowing these things and giving these facts. But because we took it as the character's trait of just like offering these pieces of advice, it seemed naturally part of the novel, but the author had done it in such a great way.
Yes.
That you got these great chunks of facts in between. And we were like, oh, it's just a little boy because he's fascinated by the world. It was quite interesting.
Yeah. All the way Ursula Vernon writes. Have you read Ursula Vernon?
No.
She's written a load of stuff that sort of goes across fantasy and horror and historical horror and children's fiction. Brilliant writer. Also writes as Tea Kingfisher. And there's...
Oh, yeah.
Have you read the...
Yeah. I know that name. I'm familiar with that name.
Yeah. So it's in the historical horror, the What Moves the Dead ones, where she sort of manages to throw in historical background and her own background incredibly well, and sort of thing just leaves you slightly green with envy because you wish you could do it that well.
Yeah.
You know, touching on what you've actually both noted, things like music, things like stagecoaches. It's the little details like that. I mean, the film references that are embedded through this, and you know, what people are watching, what people are cooking, what people are eating, what they're wearing. Weirdly, that seems to just sort of bring things to life in such a natural way when you're creating these worlds.
A friend also once told me that people will notice small things being wrong much more than they would notice big things being wrong.
I mean, I think that's probably true for the world around us, I'm sad to say. But how do you, and I think you've probably given the answer to this, so I'm going to, might as well ask the question. But how do you, when you are writing, you know, 1790 or based on a book that has values that might be slightly out of date from where we are now, or if you're writing 1930 and sort of facing the similar, how do you keep from, you know, almost putting the author's own contemporary values into the book? Or what is the distance that you want from that to, you know, be authentic to the source or to the history, but also almost bring it up to date, I suppose?
I suppose with me, part of part of the idea was I wanted to challenge Orksey a bit. I wanted to throw a few things like, you know, so just how ignorant was everyone surrounding the Scarlet Pimpernel about what was going on? Were all the rescued brides really totally ignorant of the fact that they'd been, the guys they'd rescued were part of the League of the Scarlet Pimpernel and so on? Things like, was Lady Marguerite really just going to sit in the background for the rest of her life? So I suppose part of the way so while I didn't want to keep it exactly as it had been, I managed to work off some of my own feelings by throwing a few thoughts about it in there, but I tried to keep it in character. Like, the protagonist is not suddenly going to develop into Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She's going to remain who she is, which is, in terms of social background, that changes a bit in terms of what she can accept, in terms of religious background, in terms of how she was brought up, in terms of what sort of language she'll fall back on if she got panicked or nervous or worried.
Mm. Yeah.
This is slightly off track, There was a version of the Mikado I once saw. Anyone here know the Mikado? Which has a character in it who is from a very lowly background, who's been promoted to Lord High Executioner. And the way they did it was they had him with a very affected accent. And in moments of dire stress, he fell back to Cockney, you know, is this a time for airy persiflage? It's not so much a case, for me at least, it's not so much a case of trying not to impose my own values. I wouldn't be writing a historical which had my own values in it.
Mm.
But I am having fun throwing a few catches in there to make to make the characters themselves think about why they believe what they do.
I think it's two parts to this answer. The first part is that if you create a believable world enough, the author goes in with you and understands that this is the world we're in now and these are the rules.
Yeah.
But in the same way, I think you also should have fun with it, is that for me, so the main characters in the novel are this man who comes from North India and he's very rich and he comes on a ship and he's first class. He's in the first class and the white people on the ship are like, oh, what is he doing with us here, you know? And you know what? Because my grandfather was in third class. So I get in my fiction, I get to put these Indian people come in as very rich people, which historically is inaccurate. But I'm the author of my world.
Yes.
And so I bring them in as very rich people and they open up a sugar factory, historically inaccurate. They open up a huge sugar factory and they start employing people. And so that's how you deal with it. You have fun with it and you take control of it. And the rules, it's fiction. You can do what you want and make it fun and tweak history.
Yeah. Yeah. Besides, there's nothing quite like having an annoying character who's being the mouthpiece for some of the more irritating things, sort of slapping them in the face with something, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Like that. I do want to briefly touch on the idea of memory as well. I think, so very tenuous connection between the two books, but in both there are sort of almost objects that hold memories. And I'm fascinated by that, you know, just as a concept. And I think you also touched on it with the idea of, you know, gin-like forgotten places. And now they're sort of the most comfortable there. And a house full of sort of broken and forgotten things. A 13th century manuscript that's hiding in a wine cellar that contains untold magic in a way. So I love the idea of sort of objects that hold memories. And I'm wondering if you have any in your own lives. Sorry, that you probably did not see the end of that question coming, but... but.
Sorry, I'm trying to... I have to admit, I don't usually think of it that way. Mm. I mean, when it comes to the... I don't know, when it comes to the copy of The Lord of the Rings I was given when I was 7 years old by my parents, which I still have and which I regularly reread, and every time I pick it up off the shelf, I can't help thinking, yes, this is my copy of The Lord of the Rings, this is my own... link to a lot of things.
Is that the book that in 600 years someone's going to pick up off the shelf and be possessed by the spirit of Genevieve Cogman?
Not exactly. I mean, to be honest, I'm sure your book is different, I know, but in my book, it is not a good idea to be linking your spirit to something and then going into hibernation about it. As one character puts it, everyone who's tried it went mad or was an insane ghost that had to be exorcised. The characters who did it out of desperation. And at least one of them is relieved to finally be freed and leaves with a comment of, Lord, into thy hands I descend my spirit, and so on. So it is a thing that can be done, but in this particular series I was writing, it is not a very good thing to do.
So we should not open the Genevieve Cogman Lord of the Rings, is what you're saying.
Not unless somebody locked me in the cellar to starve with it first.
Yes, fair.
But that's the thing, different settings, different ideas, different ways of handling it.
I think, I mean, that's a great question, but you should have given it to me beforehand. Yeah, so I should have given you a great answer. I mean, there's many objects that I have, but I do believe that objects have, I think so. It's why I don't like, I know it's bad for the environment, but don't like thrift shopping, because I really feel like there's a spirit of something in there. I wouldn't keep like plants in my room at night. I'll keep them outside my room because I don't know, they were outside and who knows what went on them. And I don't want it in the room at night with me. So I do have all those kind of beliefs, like even inanimate objects. I won't talk about my laptop. If my laptop is behaving badly, I'm not going to talk badly about my laptop in front of somebody. If the car has a problem, because the car for me, on some level, I know it can't hear, but on some level, I'm going to cause trouble with the car if I talk badly about it. So I always have those things. I hate saying good things out loud. I just always have these little things which make life so hard.
No, we never offend our cars. That's very important. They hear us.
Or like when you filled a bag full of shopping and you're going, stay, yes, while you grab reach for something else.
That's exactly right. Can I ask a much easier question, which is, what are you working on now and what's coming next?
How is that an easier question?
I mean, that's a lot easier than, you know, if we had to stick your soul in a book, which book would it be? I mean, that's,
I'll think about what's my favorite object.
Fair enough.
At the moment, I'm writing a new trilogy. It's basically Centrinians crossed with demon summoning. And the protagonist is the Latin teacher, new Latin teacher, who is trying to come to terms with her new school and is in heavy denial. I said, surely the girls must be joking when they talk about burning the place down, right? She was a bit desperate for a job and the headmistress offered her one.
That's fantastic. Are you on the 9-year journey for the next book?
No.
Good.
For sure, but it's still too early in my new project to talk about it.
Like fair enough. Yep.
I hate talking about things that I might bring bad luck onto, so I don't want to. But
fair enough. Yeah,
it's too early. It's what, 10, 20 pages? Come on, no.
Yeah. Well, I've been working on mine for about 10, 11 months now. So
I
can talk about mine.
You're fine. You're fine.
Yep, I'm fine.
I do, like, just to steal a quote from you on the objects, which is, I think ghosts are as real as we make them. Which I think is true. So if we do speak ill of our laptops, they will hear us.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. As real as we make them, yeah.
Genevieve, we had mentioned this ahead of time. I'm going to quote you back at you. It's really quite fun, the power. Right. Worse, he said, imagine if we lived in a country where you must carry identity papers on you at all times, where informers lurk around every corner, where criminals rule and honest men must grovel in the gutter for work. I was wondering, do you think historical fiction is still relevant today?
Well, what can I? Clearly, my stuff is purely historical. It has absolutely no relevance to any current country or regime or place or time. I suppose the thing is, history does come in cycles, though, and quite often what we will, attitudes, even if the exact circumstances may change, attitudes may recur, laws may recur. The attitude of governments towards people below them will definitely recur. And the attitude towards rich people in power when faced with people who want them out of power will definitely recur. I mean, they will find different ways to phrase it, but when they start, as they did in the 1790s, cancelling habeas corpus because of the threat of revolution from France, well, some things just recur, don't they?
It's very true. And, I mean, obviously history is recurring within that volume as well. I think it's, you know, one of the, again, tenuous connections, but both books take place in sort of uncertain political
climate.
Yes, thank you. There we go. But in both, there's sort of that lovely, and I kind of hate the phrase found family, but both of them, they are, you know, almost the solution is the sense of community and getting agency that comes out of that. And I mean, I'm sort of just hoping you have something really inspiring to say off the back of our tense times. But mostly I wanted to say that I really appreciated that in both of them, that there is that sense of agency that comes from people finding one another and building their own solutions to difficult problems. So thank you both very much for that. And they are absolutely lovely books, also filled with joy.
Say something about the djinn.
Please, let's say something about the djinn.
Just to say, because I think it's always important, and especially I don't often speak in... Actually, it's the first time I'm speaking at a festival in the UK.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say something actually about the djinn was that the reason why I wrote about the djinn, part of it, was also because it's so been overtaken by the West with the genie, which is so different from what I've been taught and from the origins of the djinn from the Quran, which is nothing like the genie in the West or the blue genie or the genie that grants you wishes or that you rub the lamp. And it's been so taken over. And I think because it was such a taboo kind of thing to talk about in our own cultures, because it's a scary thing and it's a dangerous thing, that it just got taken over by this and it became this blue genie that you grant wishes, which is unlike anything where its origin is from, which is that it's a creature made of smokeless, this is mentioned in the origins, made of smokeless fire. It's a race of its own. They will get questioned on the Day of Judgment for their bad and good deeds. They can fall in love with human beings, which is what happens with this djinn in this novel. But it was really important to me to write a story where I kind of took back, on all writers, take back that culture that was kind of stolen. So it was important to have the djinn also in the story.
And thank you for that. I love it. I mean, the djinn's a powerful character, but also just a powerful cultural existence that needed to be reclaimed.
Yeah, bravo.
Questions from anyone else in the room? Now that I've gotten to indulge my curiosity. Yes, right there.
Hello. Mine are basically both Shubnam. I'm sorry if I've said your name.
Perfect.
So over the course of writing a book over 9 years, because I'm writing my own book at the moment and it's taking a really long time, do you worry about continuity when you're writing over such a long time period? And then my second question is, how do you walk the tightrope when you're trying to do a folk horror story when you're trying to maintain the realism but also having those horror aspects without it seeming theatrical? Do you have any tips on maintaining that aspect?
So to the first question about continuity over a long period of time, you're not thinking about continuity over a long period of time. You're just thinking about, oh my God, am I going to finish this? And I just want to finish it. And please let me finish it. And please let this... You're not even thinking, will there be continuity over 9 years? I was only thinking about, when am I going to get this damn book done? So I didn't think about that. And also, when it does become a publishing deal and you have an editor, it's an amazing thing because then you're suddenly a team. And they pull everything together. So things you'd forgotten and things you might not be seeing anymore because you've been working on it for so long, your eyes are not fresh enough to see it. They sort of pull it all together and say, like, bring this, bring that, bring that. And I always describe it like it's a house, and my house was too overgrown and there was grass and branches and no light was getting in. And my agent and my editor came in and helped me clean that house and break and cut and everything until the light was in the house and we could see into the house. So don't forget, like, there'll always be help in the end. So it's, yes, have hope. And then the second thing about realism and magic. I think it's similar to the answer I gave you earlier in the sense that you create the rules for the world. So your book will have rules. And when you break the rules, that's when you're kind of the relationship between you and the author get stressed. So you have to keep a very consistent world. So a style also helps in telling that story. So it's just about feeling confident in your voice, which I didn't feel in the beginning of my novel. And it showed because at the beginning, nobody wanted my novel at the time. It did sell later on. People wanted it when I knew my voice and I knew my characters and I was strong and I felt confident about it. But when I wasn't sure about it, and you'll know it as a writer that this feels shaky. I don't feel confident in my characters and what they're saying. When they're talking and their dialogue is coming up, it's not sounding right. When you build that over, and that's the great thing about a long period of time, it does eventually come. The characters will make you laugh with what they say because then you know them so well.
Genevieve, can I throw the continuity question to you? Because especially across a long series and trilogies, and I mean, how do you keep everything straight?
I didn't have so many continuity error issues for the Invisible Library series because I had a fairly tight inner cast for that. When I was writing The Scarlet Revolution, I had a cast list, which you will see at the beginning of each book. And now that I'm currently working on the school stories, Oh, I have a big cast list, usually with notes next to all the characters, you know, so-and-so, Bursa, tends to have very horsey attitude, yikes, yeah. fond of Hong Kong movies and that sort of thing. And also, and because there are just so many characters running around at the moment, I need to have a cast list to keep track of them.
Makes sense.
And quite often when I'm busy actually reviewing the book in the editing stage, I have multiple comment tags down the side with notes like XXX, YYY, put in reference to gunpowder or whatever.
Yeah. I want to see these. It sounds fascinating.
Centrinians in general, or...
Also because, I guess I also have a question for you, is how do you produce... Because I take very long to write, and you've done quite a few trilogies. What is your writing? How do you do it?
What is your secret?
How often are you writing? And like, are you using a program like Scrivener, or are you just using Word?
I'm just using Word. I write most evenings.
For how long?
Usually I'm at the computer for a few hours, though it's not solid work. It's just a case of, I want to try and get at least a few hundred words on the page tonight.
Sometimes, but every evening?
Usually, yeah, unless I'm on holiday or I'm really totally off my beat and don't feel I can do any get anything done useful. But I just try to keep my head in it and keep working. And to be honest, mine is not just... Yours are much deeper than mine. Mine are a lot more adventure romps.
But yours are so detailed. I mean, the detail.
I'm not too bad at picking up, absorbing stuff and then regurgitating it.
Genevieve, you've got a writing background as well, before novels as well, weren't you?
I used to do some writing for what's tabletop role-playing games. I don't know if you know any tabletop role-playing games.
I mean, that was my dream job and probably still is, so yeah. That's quite cool.
I got into that by accident, but I ended up doing some freelance work which means basically they pay you for the chunk of it and that's it, for Steve Jackson Games and for Not on the Exalted Line. And before that, I was writing loads and loads of fan fiction, which is still out there somewhere.
Oh.
Fan fiction for?
Mostly,
and what was your username?
Okay, I'm not sure my username. I was writing for Bleach, Get Backers, Sayuki, okay. Mostly manga and anime stuff with a few crossovers. I did one Doctor Who Bleach crossover that never got finished. It never got finished.
Aha. So.
Put it this way, if you ever do find my stuff and you might recognise the style, that's as far as I'll say.
Right.
But I just basically used to spout out loads and loads of stuff. When I got down to actually having to write to order and to a schedule, it's become a lot more... I can produce it on sort of keep up to the deadlines, but I find it... I don't tend to be spouting out as much random stuff these days as I used to, though I do still daydream a lot.
And do you make a lot of notes? Handwritten notes? Like, do you have notebooks?
I have a notebook, but it's more a case of scribble down at the time and then... then use immediately or put in the computer path for later. I have to say that if I'm in a work meeting or something, the margins of the notes tend to have loads of comments like, at this point P enters, and car chase, and flaming leopard, and stuff like that.
I do like a work meeting where sort of the center is, you know, status, check budget, and then the column is demons.
Pretty much, yes.
Add more. Excellent. More questions?
Thank you again. I really enjoyed hearing both of you guys. One question for Shabnam. You're writing about the Indian diaspora community in South Africa, and that was really interesting. Have you had other authors you've looked to, or I haven't seen a lot in that area.
Not in South Africa. So, I mean, they are, but I really, like, what changed writing and making me realize I can create my own world is I read Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things when I was like 21, and I was like, oh my God, I can create a world with language, and it doesn't have to have rules. It can just, I know I said earlier you must have rules for your world, but I mean, you can just, you don't have to be, it doesn't have to be a story that goes from beginning to middle and end. It can just be you talking about life and how it is to live life. So I always say, like, Arundhati Roy was like my biggest inspiration for writing. Like, she just did what she wanted to do. And as a writer, you just want to be that free to be able to just tell your story how you want to tell it. Yeah. There's many South African Indian authors who have written, not always published outside of South Africa. It's really hard to get published outside of South Africa. I mean, even for me to be, it's a very rare thing. It's, for some reason, it's very hard even to get agents. If you're in the African continent, it's a very difficult thing. So, but they are, they are.
I'll have to ask you for an author list later.
We'll give you.
Other questions from the room? Right in the front.
I'm sure you have your own unique takes on this. Every author, I'm sure, does. But do you have a particular process in creating and developing your own characters, whether that be human or non-human?
Usually, when I'm starting a scene, I have a vague idea of who the characters... right at the beginning of the story, I might know who some of the characters are, but not have the others defined yet. Like, I might have, okay, the protagonist, the antagonist, several subsidiary characters, and in the current thing I'm working on, the school story thing, and several of the members of staff weren't filled in yet, and, you know, sort of, or need at this point to have antagonist fourth-year pupil who will be annoying and turn out to be dangerous. I might have some details on her, or I might develop her purely as the scene progresses and keep on developing her, like with the bit about, oh, she's the child of an MP and she tried to blackmail him because she wanted to go to Brighton for some holiday, and that's how she ended up at the school. And that was sort of spur of the moment, spinning off in the middle of a conversation about her with two other characters. And it went onto the background notes about her because it worked.
Is there like a tipping point where suddenly you're like, I know exactly, you know, they go from bullet points to I know them, I know their voice, they fully exist in my head now.
I wouldn't say I ever fully know them, but they do feel more, some feel more realized than others.
Yeah. I think for me, it was my first novel, which was only published in South Africa. I had such a bad reaction from some family members who thought there were characters based on them. I mean, I don't know, maybe subconsciously, but it was such a terrible reaction, and I was very young then, and it really traumatized me. Then when I wrote my second book, I think that's why it took me 9 years. Because I was like, nobody will ever recognize himself in this book. Every character I write will be the most strange, weird, different, from unlike anything I know. So we have a gardening, the gardening mortician was taken out, but we have a lady upstairs who plays the piano and is crazy, and we have... Just every character was so different from anybody I had ever known, because I never wanted anyone to ever point and say, that's me in your book. And so that's how those characters for this novel was created. Me going out of my way to write characters who had no similarity to anybody I knew. There's like 12 characters, so it was very hard.
I absolutely love that. I can not only see that in your family and definitely in mine, but like the whole, like, write what you know, but that's dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, what if they...
Sometimes you do borrow things from the past, though. Like when I was at school, we had a teacher who was very boisterous, very jolly hockey sticks girls. And she used to we used to have these workbooks, hardback, that we used to do the writing in. And that when she was returning them, when we'd done badly, they'd be sort of tossing them across the classroom at us and slapping them down on the desk. And that sort of mannerism I might borrow for a teacher. I mean, not borrow the whole character, but just sort of borrow that.
As long as they don't recognize it and then hassle you at family gatherings. That's the...
I wouldn't do it if it was anybody if I thought there was any likelihood of them ever recognizing themselves or even anyone ever recognizing it.
Yeah.
But it was 30 years ago, and hopefully, yeah.
I mean, and the good news, it means that your family read your book.
I don't even think they did. I think it was like amongst themselves they were... Oh. The rumor was spreading, the wrong rumor was spreading. One person had read it and then started, and then it was just... So they didn't even read it, or they didn't even buy it at least. At least they bought it or whatever.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you buy it, you can believe whatever you want. That sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Questions?
Do you worry that if you're trying to pander to other people that you lose the integrity of your writing? Say with your second book versus your first book.
Oh, you mean with the changing of the writing characters?
Of adjusting your writing style to people and trying to not capture people.
I mean, I wouldn't say I adjust my writing style. It was just the characters that I... And in a way, it helped challenge me, because I didn't look for easy ways. Because it was pulling... Like, it's very easy to pull from people, you know, but it made it harder for me, because that's why it took so long. Because I had to... really think of of characters who didn't just fall like from easy things to pull from. So I think it challenged me in a good way, Yeah, it did change it, but I liked the way it changed it. Yeah.
And there's a whole question of listening to your editor, isn't there? When the editor says, you know, have you considered, if they're being polite, they might say, have you considered doing this way? And you think, would I be giving in to popular taste if I do what?
Oh, yes.
And then you think, but then again, they are a qualified, experienced editor who knows what they're saying, and perhaps I should pay attention. And
exactly. Like, the djinn was something that was pushed a lot. It's a small character, but I think there was also this idea that it's a djinn is becoming popular. Mm. And so make the djinn a bit bigger. Make the djinn a little bit bigger in the story.
Yep. Less family, more djinn.
Or in one of the Invisible Library books, I'd put in a scene in one book which had Vale's sister, a character's sister showing up, and the editor pointed out that she had not occurred previously in the novel at all, that it was a sort of huge bump to bring her in there, that the information she needed to dump could perfectly well be given to another character that already showed up, and it would actually be smoother if that other character got to be the one who did that bit in that scene rather than her. And at first I was a bit irritated because I'd been looking forward to have her big entrance. And I thought, well, then again, she has a point. So you sort of pay attention and you think about it.
What about sort of fan or reader pressure, like across the series? You know, people, I mean, invariably everyone has an opinion and they're all going to be sharing it at you.
I think I've been fairly lucky so far in that I have not had anyone come to me and say, so-and-so, X and Y should be together. I have no objection to them writing their own fanfic about it. That's what fanfic's for. I just can't read it. I mean, this is an author thing, isn't it? Because if you ever look at somebody's fanfic and then years later you write something that might be anything closely relating to it, or even just dealing with the same two characters, they might raise their hand and go, you stole that from me.
Yeah.
And the only defense an author has is to be able to say, no, I have never looked at any fanfic, which is, that's partly why authors don't read fanfic, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but I do appreciate that question because you're always constantly, it's either you edit it or you're trying to write against something, or there's what is fashionable, or what does my fans want? And you have to constantly think, and because like I say, as being a writer, you have to like think, what is my voice and what am I doing? But there are all these external things and the marketing, like this would be marketed more, this would sell more if I write more about this. So it is a tough question that you always have to face when you're writing.
I did think in the first place in the Pimpernel books, you know, shall I go with a standard romance or shall I go with something a bit less reasonable, a bit less unusual? I ended up going with the standard romance and with the two female characters going, you know, sort of we shall be friends and sisters forever. But it could have gone the other way. I mean, just in the end, it felt more like the original to have the protagonist and the male main character wander off into the sunset together. I did consider it.
Before we wander off into the sunset, see what I did there? It's very good. Let's give them a big round of applause, is it?
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.